things happen for a reason. I mean, what would have happened if I went there and I had a brilliant World Cup? The boys had the plan, but they didn't believe how well it was working.
Okay, this morning, we are so excited, me and Arthur, because let's just go back to Arthur. Kobani. I mean, we were challenging each other this morning.
Yeah, I mean, to the palate.
Remember, I'm Potter Stream, I'm a Dutchman.
Oh, I thought lovely. You were, when you were trying to pronounce it, I thought you were from Palville with a K. But anyway.
That's a great morning.
Everybody would have seen our guest this morning already on our shootout with Hotshots. And we were sitting at Hotshots, and we were filming with Otwa and Ryan, and all of a sudden we just got chirps from the
in his pajamas.
So guys, I just want to come up for Bob's completely that shot we caught him completely off guard that day. But let me just do a quick intro. We've got an ex-professional rugby player with us, and we'll go into a bit of detail on that today. And then a legendary commentator, Bob's, and 100% legendary. And I call it in Afrikaans the bibliotheek of data. So, you know, in the old days when you see an office, that old school offices, and they've got that big, thick books.
Those encyclopedias.
Encyclopedia.
That's for the common man, and I'm a common man. That's my definition of Bob's this morning. But thank you so much for joining us. We are so grateful and so honored. And just for everybody, we know these formats are sometimes long. You know, yeah. Arthur, we spoke about that. And we want to keep it to the point, you know, for everybody, because we know a lot's going on, so we don't even judge people. But today is going to be a little bit about your story, because I think there's two very interesting moments in your life there that a lot of youngsters and a lot of people can learn from. We're going to talk a little bit about golf and then rugby. Mm-hmm. That's how we're going to end the segment. So just a preload of where we're going to go. Arthur, morning to you.
Morning. I'm very pumped for today.
Yeah.
Before we start, I thought I'd just mention, I've already told them the story. So when I was a teenager and I saw a chick with really, really nice boobs and we were walking around with friends, you know, I'd say, how are those Kobani Bobos? And no one would know what we were talking about. So I'm so glad your new presence is with us today.
Nah, you guys are far too kind, and I know our gate crashed the last time. It was just, I could not hold myself back seeing two mates who I hold dear to heart, Akona and Kanko, who I gave the nickname of the Hoff, because he looked like old the back in the day Michael Knight, David Hasselhoff, with his hair, you know, like boy from St. Andrews rocking up from the academy, at the Sharks Academy, and he had this hair, and I was just like, oh, this guy looks like the Hoff. Just those two great gents, and thank you for your warmth, because you guys got me to get into the Hotshots, and what a cool sort of establishment that is, and yeah, golf has become something that I'm I could say I'm indebted to it because of what sort of mental health and gains I've gone from it, and just, you know, having a space where you can be competitive again, which is very always welcoming for someone who's been in the probably. To me, my biggest arena is where I had to be competitive, and golf has given me that sort of vibe again and that sort of driving edge. So, yeah, thank you so much for having me, and good morning.
Oh, thanks, Bob. Because, you know, we want to put a little bit more story to the one we always hear.
Yeah.
And we just spoke about it, your familiar voice.
Yeah.
You know, that it's, you know, you do a lot of voiceover stuff as well, but that we always, everybody, you know, sits around you and spends hours with you over the weekends.
Yeah.
And, you know, such a big personality on Supersport. And for everybody now, when they watch it this weekend, you commentating and doing analysis with the teams, they can at least know a little bit more about the person that's giving us that information, where the passion and stuff comes from. And maybe on that point, you know, I said to you that there's two parts of your life that I find very interesting. It doesn't mean that there's not a lot more stories around your life.
Sure.
But the one is, so Eastern Cape, Kings William Towns to Rondebosch, and then turning that into professional athlete. And that's probably where the golfing side does come from, because it's a competitive nature.
Yeah.
As boys, we like chirping, and you're a professional athlete by nature, so the competitive is installed in you. It's ingrained. It's part of your DNA.
Yeah.
So just talk us a little bit through that journey and where we ended up.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I mean, born in Zwelitsha, township just outside King Williamstown.
Yeah.
My dad was a massive, massive fan of Dell College rugby and Dell College, just the school in town. And his dream was to always take his son there. And I was fortunate enough. I come from a family of six. My father passed away. My older brother passed away. So I'm left with my mom and my two sisters. So I was a fortunate one to go to Dell College. And it was one of my dad's proudest moments. He always wanted to see his son dressed up in Dell College sort of uniform, walking down in town with his basher. I was never into rugby. I won't lie. I was more into football. My dream was to play and study and go to Wits University and get myself into a Kaizer Chiefs team. And then from there, move to Man United. And then play for Real Madrid, striker, wherever they wanted me. I was ready. I never knew that I'll get to Ellis Park in a different sort of a form of jersey and everything. But
so more the Benny route.
Yeah, it was interesting. I went to this school, Dell College, and then when I got there, the first thing that we had was first team trials in the first term, and after that we had a first team test. Just for me, I mean, I'm like I said, I've never had a clue about rugby, and all of a sudden we're having a first team test. I couldn't tell between a prop and a fullback. I thought a prop was like a full team.
This in grade eight.
This is like in grade eight, standard six, because I was still in standards those days. And but this was for the whole boarding house. So we all had to, it didn't matter if you were in matric or in six, whatever you were, you had to know the first team. I mean, it was not even published out in the school, but we had to go find out and figure it out, and all the other players sort of knew what was going on, the guys who'd been at the school. And I sort of saw the how big of an impact that rugby had at the school. And then you start seeing like CB Jennings, one of the former Springboks. You start seeing H.O. de Villiers, the fullback that played in the 70s and Western Province legend and the Springbok. And then you sort of think to yourself, okay, This is something I need to get into. And especially if you go to a boys' school, you want to be welcomed. You want to be in a place where you can have a sense of belonging.
Yes.
And rugby gave me that. And I remember, it's a tradition. It was all that school was about. I remember my very first game playing at Tighthead, because my dad owned a butcher.
Tighthead?
Yeah.
I read something about that. Sorry.
How big were you when you were in school?
So I was, for under 14 those days, so I weighed about a good 70-odd kilograms.
Okay, that's a good one.
I was pretty sturdy, you know. It was quite fun. But the one thing is that I had the speed and I had the pace, and I guess from playing football, I sort of understood the sort of jinking eye-hand coordination and had a peripheral vision of seeing space. So I didn't last long playing at prop. I moved on to be a flanker, because I used to break off and leave my my flanks behind and chasing the 10, because I thought that's what it was. I mean, they said break, I was breaking. I was like, I'm going. And I scored a try in my first game. And my under 14, I was playing under 14 Bs. And my under 14 Bs coach was my English teacher. He's the one who gave me the nickname Bobes. You know, he was like, okay, this Gobani thing is not going to cut. So he was like, hey,
the struggle
Bones
is real.
I was like, okay, cool. And for me, I always wanted to sort of make that guy proud, because I sort of enjoyed the interest that he showed in me as a young boy, trying to find myself in the school, and that is like a boys' school, and knowing how everyone is so boisterous. And then I found my best mates, which I played with from under 14 A's all the way to first team at Dell College, the Swindler brothers. They were twins. They came from Western Province Prep. So from there, I started really enjoying my game, and I wanted to work hard at it. I wanted to replicate and see whatever, who was doing whatever. Every tight end, I followed Olo Brown. I just wanted to be like him because now I'm playing tight end. And then I played on the loose forwards. Michael Jones was a big inspiration to me because of the player he was and what he could do on the field. I thought, like, Michael Jones, to us rugby sort of lovers and back in the day, he was our Michael Jordan. You know, he was that guy who was just so special, and he just brought something different. And that came on, and then I remember a situation playing in the Queen's reunion down in Queenstown. My dad comes up. He always wanted to drive me to the games, and he was very proud, you know. So we drove with my dad, and we got there, I played under 14s and watched our first team, and this to me was huge. I thought rugby was only to the first team, because these guys we used to sing for. We had a school hymn where we had the rugby songs that we had to learn, and on that day, it was just a readmission of South Africa to world stage. And we were playing against the All Blacks in 1992 at Ellis Park.
Yeah,
and I remember watching that game and thinking to myself, oh, it gets bigger? And then after that, I started watching Currie Cup. Then I was like, wow, this rugby thing is big. I could not believe that I was missing out on this. The only time I used to see rugby was probably Uli Schmidt biting someone's ear. And then Uli Bullies coming out and Leon Schuster's. Yeah. And that's all I knew. I was just used to think this game is ridiculous. It's a bunch of barbarians trying to kill each other.
Bunch of whiteies.
And then I was like, this is so fun for me, because I had quite a streak when I was young. I felt it was hard for me to express myself, sort of like articulate what I felt. So I was a bit aggressive. So I had this sort of very much, if we didn't meet halfway, we might as well meet outside the classroom and sort it out, you know. And rugby gave me a chance in a space where I could use that aggression and be on that field and contribute in a positive and add value towards my team. And that for me was like, if you put me on the rugby field, it didn't matter whatever was happening around me. I felt I was in heaven.
It's crazy.
I suppose, but you had quite a journey, because I'll get to the second part, which is obviously a devastating injury period that you went through.
I didn't tell you, actually, going to Rondebosch.
Yeah.
So I told you about the Swindler twins. So they got let go at Dell College, and they went to Rondebosch. So there was a group of us. We were becoming very naughty. I was in grade 10, standard 8, and I was playing first team. I was 15, turning 16. Just luckily enough, find of the season that year, and things were happening for me. I was captain of the SA under 17 side, played Craven Week, and they were like, "Are we going to Rondebosch?" And then my mate says, so we went to the under 17 tour to France, funny enough. And we went to France and we were playing in Marseille and we were playing against other teams. And then he was like, there's an end of the year tour for Rondebosch in that year. They're going to the UK and Ireland. So I was like, I want to be part of this. So I gave a ring to the coach then, who was Spencer King, who was a referee, Currie Cup ref. Said, Spence, is there any chance that I can get into Rondebosch? I heard that there's a space in the boarding house. And now the toughest thing was to try and sell that story to my dad of why I'm going to Rondebosch. So sort of came up with something like, no, you know, better opportunities, bigger city, bigger playing pool. Hopefully the opportunity will rise. And my dad was very supportive. Yeah. I mean, he enjoyed the fact that I was so in love with this game. And he was like, no, it's fine. I was like, cost of the schooling doesn't change. I mean, I'm still staying in the boarding house anyway whilst I was a few minutes away from school. So that's how I got to Rondebosch.
Just like, and, you know, your dad there, I honestly just got a vision from, just imagine how proud he was, you know, for that to come and to fruition, the dream that he had.
Yeah.
But where did he got his, and I know, I don't want to,
sure,
but where did he get his love for rugby?
So just to take you back, if you drive through the Eastern Cape, the only thing you see, it doesn't matter how rural the area is cricket pitches and rugby posts. Rugby has been played by the Eastern Cape black people since 1892.
My goodness.
This is before the 1906 Springboks. It's a missionaries coming into the country, and the only way they thought that the people who worked and they could sort of get them to sort of come and get the values of respect, camaraderie, working together, team working, and all of that. So they formed a side. I think Morocco, Swallows in Makanda, which was former Grahamstown, where the first game was played, missionaries playing against the workers. And that grew and it took flight and it was like wildfire. The biggest games that used to happen in the rural areas probably still do happen now was playing for half a sheep or half a cow. Players would come. I mean, they'll stop a game because the number 10 who works in the mines in the Teba days has not arrived because maybe on the way he had a few. And they'll stop that game because they needed to see that 10. And it was villages playing against villages. And that tradition has always been there for us in the Eastern Cape. For my dad, me playing football, it was like, what are you doing? It's an abomination.
Yeah.
I mean, you're supposed to be playing rugby. This is what your uncles know. This is what we've played. This is what we do. And playing cricket in summer. It's just one of those things that my dad was a chairman of the, funny enough, and this is such a coincidentally, a rugby club in the township called the All Blacks in Zone 10. And he was quite, because he was self-employed. He had his own business, a businessman, an entrepreneur, owned butcheries. He had his own construction company. And was someone who was always willing to sort of stretch his imagination and beyond what was supposed to be accepted for him. And he was a very ambitious man. And someone who I thoroughly admired, and I've always wanted to sort of like see that man proud of me, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a third child in my family, so can you imagine how much I was gunning for attention?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And so, and then we had this thing. This rugby was our thing. I think I forced him to get the decoder in the 80s so that I could wake up and watch games. He used to be like have his old nightmares or whatever, stressing him about business. And you'll find me in the living room just watching the game. And then I'll like sort of break down what was happening. And he's like, I didn't even know there was the bloody Super Rugby. And I'm like, Daddy, it's happening. I'm telling you. So, no, I mean, one of the special things was like any other boy, they say that there's three stages between a father and a son. Your dad is your hero, then you demonize him, and then you sort of get back to sort of say, you know what, you're right. Yeah. What was really going on? So it was one of those stages when it was like, you're right. And we had a few sort of like clashes in what and how I wanted to go about what I wanted to do, thinking that I know everything. I'm a teenager now. And after a while, we haven't had spoken. I was called out for the Springbok squad. And we played against Scotland. My first Springbok jersey, I remember giving it to him. And he just welled up. And I remember, like, it was yesterday when we just hugged and we just sat there. It's just quiet moments. And it was someone who was an All Black fan because of what the past was.
Of course.
And all of a sudden, his son was bringing a Springbok jersey to him. So that was a special moment I'll always treasure.
Sure. That was an incredible story you just shared there with us. Can I ask what was that moment like when you gave him the Springbok jersey?
I mean, you know, my dad is he never tried to live vicariously through me. He let me do what I was doing. My mom will always tell me how proud he is about my achievements in the game, me playing. He was very fond of the fact I captained Border. Under 17, and he used to just scream Border, and there was like what it was, Basil Canyon heaving, and then he would talk a lot and be very loud to his mates, but to me he was just like nothing happened, you know. It was just like, I remember I was so nervous before games. I mean, playing first team, and he was driving me around, taking me to the games, and I could sense that he was nervous. But it's the way that he postured. He always seem like quietly confident, like nothing has happened, my boy. We are here. We're here to dominate. And it was such support and something that, yes, it was great to go to Rondebosch and play there. But I sometimes like sort of feel for him because he didn't get to see me every weekend.
Yeah. Listen.
Yeah, I am that kind of guy.
And Bob, I tell you what, and I told you this morning, you know, we've also learned about all of this. Actually, we're just three guys here trying to make it in life.
Sure.
Raise our kids, play our role in a better South Africa.
Yeah.
In a very innocent way, you know.
Yeah.
We always judge people when they walk around sometimes, but we're all just trying to sort of play our role. Give it a positive, leave it better than what we found it at, make the differences where we can. I'm the same for this podcast, you know.
Sure.
This podcast is not a commercial venture where we are sitting and going, oh, it's so wonderful to... It's moments like this that just reiterates to me, we have to tell more stories because it changes everything. You know, if you think about the importance and dynamics of the role that a father plays in a kid's role.
Yeah.
And how you still had that opportunity. And I can sort of visualize this for your dad and sorry that he saw what you've achieved at such a young age.
Yeah.
I have no doubt when he left this world, he had all the confidence in the world that his son will make something of his life.
Yeah. That's
the biggest piece you can ever find as a parent.
Oh, but you seem like as if you were there. So I retire in 2011. I come back home. And for about a month, not knowing what I'm going to do, I stay with my dad and I sit with him just every day, just sitting there, just having that quiet time, comfortable quietness of just want to be here. I haven't been around. I haven't been at home for a while. And things were not going well for him. His businesses were getting torn apart. The taxman was at him. And he looked at me and he said, I'm sorry. I said, were you sorry? And he says, yeah, no, things are not the way they used to be. I said, Dad, you can never be sorry to me. You've raised four kids. You've given us education, given us an opportunity. I love you. I appreciate you for everything you have done. And I moved back to Joburg. Started to pursue broadcasting with SuperSport, coaching. Had my coaching levels done in Newcastle when I was there. And mom gives me a call and says, your dad is not doing well. So I was like, no, I'm not going to entertain this. I'm going to have to push. I have to be strong. I have to push. My dad won't want me to be sort of coming around and sort of have giving him that sort of, oh, sorry, look at you now type of thing. And then my cousin called me and he was like, you need to come home. Like yesterday. So I flew down, went to go see my dad in the hospital, and my mom was just hysterical, and she's like, this guy hasn't said anything. I'm not too sure what's going on. I mean, how can he do this to us? So I said, no, mom, just let me have a chat. And he's like, yeah, I'll speak to your dad. So I'm like, dad. And he hadn't shown any reaction for like a week. And he sort of blinkered, looked at me, and after that he was like, no, everything is fine, he's here now. And that was our last sort of like interaction. And that gave me confidence. At the same time, I had a bit of peace because he waited for me, which is in a selfish way, he waited for me. And for that, I'm always reminded of what is important, you know. I always say, people will always say, no, you're so humble, you got humility. And I'm like, but we are raised by great people. The only thing we can do is trying to be great. Mm-hmm. And that man taught me who I am, and I know who I am.
Sure.
I didn't want to make this so deep. It's in the morning.
No, it's exactly why we do this. Bob's. It's because there is. It feels like the parental role is being very challenged. at the moment in the bigger scheme of the world. And we live in a country that requires that type of stability. And we need these type of stories to give courage to young women and men that are in that same positions that you and Odwa and Akana and all of them came from, and see on them. And, you know, and I'll, you know, so appropriately raise this. I can now see where the toughness comes from as well. And the other day, and this might not be, you know, the most controversial statement ever, but we sat around the table the other day and we looked at the squads. And remember, there was in the beginning, everybody challenged a little bit of the BE structures that came into sport. But if you look at the teams we've put together now, something in rugby has shifted at some stage where they could produce these type of players.
Yeah.
And if you look at the squad now across nationalities, colour, there's not a single other member.
Backgrounds.
Nobody is challenging the squad.
Yeah.
That squad is the best squad.
It is.
Wow.
We can possibly have. And I just go back, you know, a few years where it's always sort of raised. And you know, in all of our mate circles, there's always some parts that are still hanging on to certain old school thinking.
Yeah.
And I say it's across cultures.
Yeah, I've it happens it across culture, all cultures, of us.
You know. But it's these moments that you sit here and you're like, we're all just a bunch of people, humans born in this earth, right or wrong, different struggles and growing up in. And what you just told there about your dad is so personal to me and Arthur, and what roles they play in our roles. But to encourage young people, you know, to know that when you grow up, whatever circumstances you find yourself in, you're going to climb yourself out of that.
True.
If you just have the mindset
True. And
listen to moments like this.
Yeah.
Because it's f***ing inspirational.
Well, man, it's, you know, like I always tell people, like, I come from a privileged situation. Like my folks had money when I was growing up. Something that, for me, I sort of, there was a time I resented that because I thought they thought that they could just give us the money to fill up for the hug, for the love.
Yeah.
Everything was about bringing the bacon home. Yeah, now it sounds like I'm very spoiled to say that. Yeah. But it's that, funny enough, the human touch in the human golf show.
Yeah.
When someone sort of shows you how much you mean to them, how much you're there for them. New pair of sneakers won't make me love you anymore. I remember going through speaking to one of the therapists when I was younger because they thought that I was challenged because I was just had this sort of like single-mindedness of that this is who I am and I'm not going to buck for anyone. And they were saying that the only thing a child wants to see is trying to see their parents happy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not how much money they turn and bring at home.
Irrelevant.
As long as you are happy, we reflect to that.
Yeah.
And I took that on board and I was like, you know, with all of that that has happened, it was all for a good reason because it made me look at my dad's sort of achievements and think they were mine. I wanted to be my own man. I wanted to achieve things. I wanted to make my family proud. It's funny enough because every time he used to say, I hear these people calling you Bobo. You're not Bobo. Bobo is our father. And I was like, yeah, you're right. You're right. You're right. But it is just those ambitions. I mean, I'm from the Eastern Cape, Izwelitsha. So I'm like sitting back there. I'm like, every time I'm watching TV, I'm like, there's so many Chabalalas and everyone is in Auckland Park. Yeah. And I'm like, I want to get my name in the mix there. I mean, no one has seen this name. Everyone thinks I'm Nigerian. They see my surname anyway. So like, it's the funniest thing. Like I remember rocking up in Joburg, getting into a taxi, going to see my mates. And there was a time the cops pulled the taxi over and they wanted to see our IDs. And so I'm a bit bulky. I'm a bit masculine. I don't look South African, supposedly in their eyes.
Yeah.
Black guy on a black guy. Nice. and he goes, where are you from? So I'm like, you know, got this accent. I'm from King William style. He's like,
no.
Not in 13 years since I've been a detective that you are from King William's Town. why don't you just go back to where you're from, either Zambia or Kenya, wherever it is.
Yeah.
Just don't lie to me. And if you don't, if you keep on lying to me, I'm going to lock you up.
Yeah.
And I didn't have my ID that time. And I was like, man, only if he knew.
Yeah.
Like, so then I sort of flipped it up and spoke in Xhosa. And then he was like, you could have learned that. So I was like, oh, well. Oh, well, I can't win here. So, yeah, it's just all these constant reflections and getting to know yourself and meeting people who show you your value. And then you sort of understand what your role you have to play.
So was now take me, I mean, that part of your life, you know, to break through all of that, the challenges that you faced. I mean, honestly, I didn't expect that this morning. Mm. How inspirational this is just for me to listen to it. This type of shit humbles you straight back to earth. That the bigger picture of what we're trying to all do here,
yeah.
The rat race.
Yeah.
And the pressures of society where today, you know, society's success is put on where your dad lives and your parents buy you or where they put you, where it's just, especially the way I grew up, it's a lot of in my life because one day when you're older, all of that
is gone.
Completely irrelevant.
And you can't take it with.
Mm. And you can't take any of it with. And to be honest with you, I don't really hang in those circles because most of the time, in my opinion, a lot of them are just a bunch of and I don't relate to their conversation or their visuals,
sure.
their values in life and how they look after people. And we always say that, you know, Skulk Brits walks in here, everybody's going to get greeted.
And a hug,
and maybe a kiss on the cheek.
And then you'll have a spoiled little brat that walks in there with 21, no achievement behind them, and they come in with this cocky attitude.
Like, who are you?
Yeah, and I just want to slap them down, and not even in a physical.
Don't
sense.
Worry, the karma will do that.
But luckily, the world does that. You know, the world tells you, listen, I couldn't give a shit who you are, and you remember those days of, do you know who I am?
Do you know who I am?
People have now been put into their own category, and they live their own little privileged lives between Johannesburg and Cape Town.
Sure. You know?
Let them travel in their own circles. This is for the real people here that drives the economy and jobs and creations and all of that.
We're trying to keep the lights on.
We're trying to keep the lights on. But just on that quickly, if you don't mind, I just want to go on to another big hurdle that you faced.
Sure.
And I know that there's a lot in between because Blue Bulls, you played for the Lions, there were Springbok colors. Nick Mallett referenced you specifically in interviews. So I'm not trying to take anything away from that. But then there was a massive, massive, massive challenge you faced. When you talk about injuries, you know, you talk about, I got an injury 6 to 8 weeks, maybe 12 weeks later, I'm back on my feet.
Yeah.
For you, this was a devastating one. And almost call it career ending.
Yeah. I mean, 20 years ago, 2003, I get a call up from Rural Australia to the Springboks. And we play a test series against Scotland. I make my debut at Ellis Park. Great times. I mean, this is a place that's given me a professional rugby career. And I'm running on in front of this crowd. And funny enough, I think one of my first touches, I hit into a gap. And it felt like a gun was shot. I've never heard a crescendo or sound like that. I looked around, I thought, what the hell had happened? And I was in the gap. And I was like, oh, this is how it feels. And yes, you're right. Like most people always say, like when you make your test debut, it just goes like that. But that 15, 10 meters felt like a lifetime. And I got hooked in this drug. And I was like, I want to taste this forever. And I mean, when you're young, you think to yourself, cheapest life. What is 50 caps?
Yeah.
I'll make that easy.
Yeah.
And
especially
then,
for a backline
plan. Yeah, especially in your backline plan, you're thinking to yourself, oh, this is a lifetime thing. This is supposed to happen. I'm the one. I am him. Let's go.
Yeah.
So we get to Rugby World Cup. They name the squad, 30-man squad. I'm in the squad. I'm like, worked my butt off. I remember the challenge that I was put on. And I had to face up to was we played All Blacks that year. It was Nelson Mandela's birthday. We played in Pretoria, 1652, Jan van Riebeeck. I'm sitting on the bench. I don't get on. And you start to doubt yourself because you're thinking, I mean, we're getting 50 and this guy's not putting me on.
Yeah.
And then remember, because my dad was there watching, and he was wearing my number 12 jersey. And one of the guys, Afrikaans guy in Pretoria, yada, your money is a c-. So my dad stands up, he says, yeah, they were. It's a pity that they didn't put my sign on, because you'll have shown them.
Yeah.
Get to Australia, someone gets picked ahead of me. I'm still on the bench, don't get to play. And then it was the All Blacks, which just gave us 50 in Pretoria. And now I'm trusted to start a game in Dunedin, the House of Pain.
Yeah, House of Pain.
The same place where I tore my first ligaments, my knee injury ligaments. And now I start this game, and it's famously known for the best prop try ever. Richard Bands streaking down the line, bouncing people, scoring a try. And it was most like fulfilling moment I had playing against All Blacks, seeing the crowd and seeing all of that. So we go to a Springbok camp, World Cup squad is named Camp Staaljot.
Yeah.
So I was there. So do it hard, we do it tough. And I'm probably in the best shape of my life. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, let me go. Watch me get out there. Watch me make us something. You know, watch me show all those youngsters in Zwelitsha, youngsters in Khayelitsha, wherever they are, youngsters in Kuruman, Krugersdorp, what a South African can do. You know, I had that confidence in me because I knew I've prepped hard. And we play a warm-up game against the Free State Cheetahs. Louis Kuhn puts a grabber through. I chase after the ball. Ball bounces to the right. And I'm trying to turn towards it because I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be an easy try. It's just to start the game, you know, make it easy.
Yeah.
Let's get going. My body says, no, but it's not a type of day. My knee just buckles underneath me. And I'm sitting there. And I just can't put pressure on my knee. And my leg just keeps on giving away. I remember Uli Schmidt was our doctor, tough man.
Yeah, because people forget there were doctors and lawyers back then.
Yeah, yeah. He comes and he sort of gives me the little check. But Uli being Uli, he's like, you can run this thing off. I'm like, it's torn. It is off. So I got up and I was trying to contribute, you know. And I could see that I could not put pressure on it. And my knee just kept on giving. So I literally just jogged off the pitch. And I thought to myself, maybe, you know, it's one of those things. You can strap it up. Let's go. And I went for a scan. And then they showed me my ligaments was just like Brussels sprouts, man. It was just like torn. Everything was gone. And I was out for 9 months. And I missed out on the World Cup. And it was heartbreaking, but at the same time, I sort of have this thing in my head, like things happen for a reason. I mean, what would have happened if I went there and I had a brilliant World Cup and we'd done everything? I would have been a total different person, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I was young then, I was like 24 old.
Yeah.
So I would have probably be thinking that, come on. Everyone owes me something. But now this sort of brought me down to earth, and it's just the second time I'm having this long-term injury. And I just took it in. I just said to myself, you know what? Maybe I need this to sort of build in relationships, because most of the time when you're trying to pursue a dream that seems impossible, you sacrifice a lot, and you sacrifice a lot of relationships with that. So I've got time to catch up with a lot of my siblings. My brother moved up to Joburg. He stayed with me, caught up with my sisters, and I started sort of having just the normal life, you know. I've never thought that rugby defined who I was. It is something that I was maybe privileged and blessed to have a talent to, but it didn't sort of define me. It's not something that I walk around in. It's probably sometimes strange. I see someone like looking at me twice, and I'm like, the hell does he think I am? Yeah. Who the hell does he think I am? I'm like, who? And you forget, right? Because you don't want to walk around thinking that you're this guy. And I'm like a normal human being. I'm just trying to make it, like you're saying. And life is that simple. And so I had a time to reflect, and it was tough, but at the same time, I'm privileged to have had that time, because I knew that there's more to me, and this was not going to be the one to describe and or tell my story.
It's like, Bob, as I listen to you, I feel like a young
person.
He's
not just a pretty face.
He's not just because he's definitely pretty boy. I just don't think I had the same awareness as you did when you were at a young age.
I would have, at 24, and that happened to me, I thought my life would have ended.
You're embodying it the whole time.
I would have been clinically depressed, clinically depressed, because it's amazing how you had the consciousness of not defining it. Because I can tell you now, and you know this better than me and Arthur, I think in most cases, it does define them.
Yeah.
That's what defines them. And when it happens, it's very difficult to navigate that struggle.
Sure.
But it's stories like this and others that tell people to take a deep breath in that moment.
Yeah.
And then see, okay, where do I go from now? Because obviously the end result of where you sit today, and I'm assuming you're one of those guys that no matter where you are today, you probably feel you've underachieved anyway.
Yeah.
So it's incredible that you can pick that up. And I just want to change the lightness
of the conversation let's go.
Now a little bit, if you guys don't mind. But just give us a quick segment, because then we'll go into the rugby segment.
Sure.
But where did this – because, I mean, for you to be in your pajamas –
at the World
of
Golf.
What was it?
It was 8:30 or 9 o'clock.
8:30 or 9 o'clock or whatever.
Just dropped my son off.
Yes. Just dropped his son off, you know.
I thought let me go solve life problems by hitting a golf ball.
This love, that the sport that we absolutely just love.
Yeah.
And, you know, and me and Arthur always speak about this. And it's not that I'm always bringing in, but what I really enjoyed about that day and what I'm learning very quickly as well, a black four ball and a white four ball.
Yeah.
There is the similarities.
Yeah.
Is incredible.
Serious.
The chirping.
Yeah.
The betting.
The betting. The camaraderie. The chirping. You know? Because
the competitiveness.
Yeah. We are a show, Bubs, that really embrace okay, yeah. the humor between black and white players.
You have to.
I mean, it's just classic.
Who we are.
I played with Jimmy Tao this last Saturday.
Ridiculously long. Sneaky long.
I tell you, the
sneaky long.
Sneaky long. He is a sneaky yeah. long. And you know what I said to Jimmy? He's actually irritatingly long. Because Jimmy isn't the youngster of the youngs anymore.
Yeah.
Buddy, when that man swings, and you know, I've got a little bit of distance in me.
Yeah, he's also quick.
I was like maybe 5 meters ahead of him. And then I said to him at some stage, I said, I don't play with people that's normally with me on the
close
drive.
Close up to me.
You know what I mean? I said, Jimmy, take a back seat, buddy. me and him breached the conversation as
yeah.
well. You know what? How the sport has changed, and you know, we both of us are at Bryanston.
Sure.
How the dynamics of Bryanston have also changed.
Yeah.
And it is incredible. We should just embrace each other a lot more on that. And bridges get literally thrown out of the way on a day like a golf day, because, like Jimmy and I said to each other, you know, this is the type of sport. Like South Africa, you know, sport plays a very, very special role in our political world, in our human world between us.
Sure.
In our DNA.
It's a yeah. very different, and it is. There's no other country that has the 1994 transition, the 95 World Cup win. There's no country that has that historic sport.
Yeah.
And the best of it all is, you always think about it, Mandela, to be locked up for the long that he does, but that he had this vision of sport being able to change the game. You know, to change
the country.
The country.
Wow.
Give me a bloody CEO that has that type of vision and has that type of, they normally think product and wealth and money.
Yeah.
Where he was just like, this could be the
because the savior.
I mean, 100%. Remember, he had to take the helicopter ride to meet them on the field the sure. day before. He landed literally on the rugby field. I don't know.
Can I tell you my Nelson Mandela story?
Yeah, of course. Anytime.
So Maybe that's what made me sort of feel not so hurt. After I tore my ligaments, I was invited to come and have lunch with him. So I went to his house in Gauteng. doesn't stay too far away from me. I stay in Killarney in the flat.
then across the road.
Just across the road, you know what I mean? Just bigger across yards and everything. And I rock up to his house. And I walk in. And my goodness, I've never felt so important. This man literally called me a maestro. He said, "How are you doing, maestro?" So me, I'm standing there. I mean, I'm a closer man.
He's
an elder to me.
Yeah.
He's my grandfather. Yeah, so I'm like, Tatumkulu, grandfather.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm out of words. And this man was just like talking to me like I'm this greatest thing ever. And that is what was special about him. I mean, I felt so, so comfortable. And when I shook his hand, I was like, I shook the hand, I shook the world, you know? And his warmth that he had, and we had these grandkids, and we're sitting all there, and we're having lunch. And he was just literally telling, he told me a story, which was a very interesting story, because I know that he is a well-calculated man. He doesn't just tell you a story. Yeah. So it's a story about him coming to Johannesburg with, back then, the King Taliwonga, who was supposed to be the king of the one of the chief kings back in the Eastern Cape of the Xhosa people, the Matembu Royal. And he didn't want to take his stand as a king. So he decided that he wanted to pursue law and pursue politics and push for this reconciliation and liberation of people. And then he says, and then the people were sent to come and fetch him. And I was standing there, and he looked at me and he thought that I was going to do something. This is what he says. And I said, you know what? This is almost like beyond my pay grade. You have to go serve the people. And if that means that our relationship never becomes the same again, but you got a bigger purpose than I do. And I was just sitting there and I was just throwing backwards. I was like, why are you telling me this? Yeah. You know, and I'm sort of getting it now. It's starting to clear. Like really what was meant. And I've sort of sat down and sort of meditated and thought about it. And it's just what in a man, what an occasion. I mean, for that, I'll always be grateful for the injury.
Yeah. You'll see a very special when you go to my office, Bob. a signature from him on a personal photo.
Yeah.
That he did. My dad played he was at that stage the only white Zulu speaking lawyer, advocate, and eventually judge.
Wow.
That Nelson Mandela appointed him back in those days. And he could write full Zulu.
Yeah.
He grew up in KZN, KwaZulu-Natal, and Vryheid, Pongola. Yeah. So he could, and for, you know, whatever reason, and there was obvious reasons to it, you know.
Yeah.
My dad eventually then played quite a big role, and we won't go into any of that today.
Sure.
But I've got his photo next to my grandfather that played a role in the apartheid days.
Yes.
Early 40s and 50s. And then Nelson Mandela and my dad that played a role after that.
Yeah.
After 1995. Amazing. Actually started in the late 80s with him. So it's a very special part of my life.
And that's got amazing.
Him, I've got him in my office. I stare at that photo every single day.
Wow. No,
I was only 4 years old.
Let's not go back there.
The experienced people will take this
conversation. Let's not go back there. I thought I'd just add my two cents.
You were probably just that in a
I was still in a diaper.
But Bob's the... Then, sorry.
We were talking about Jimmy and how the sport and golf.
Yeah, and it's just incredible. And I know that you have this incredible love for the game of golf. And I wanted to dive into that slightly, but I know under time constraints here. So maybe let's dive into the rugby side.
Sure.
Okay. So, Arthur, let's just set the tone here quickly. We know the show has taken a diversion in the last 3 weeks.
It's
Rugby World Cup.
That's who we are.
I mean, come on. And it's amazing that Ryan and O'Connor, when we had them on, the interaction on that post that we got. I'm telling you now, hundreds of that. I think you got 100,000 views on TikTok or something like that.
Yeah, on Instagram.
Wow.
So we thought it might be quite appropriate then to bring the bibliothèque with us this morning. And give us a little bit of proper insight, because we are outdated with that conversation. Mm. You know, a lot has happened subsequent to this. So, Wabs, I think between you and Arthi, tell me where you are at the moment with this rugby. What put a few spin on this for us.
We
biggest weekend of our lives.
So, like, I won't lie, it was interesting. Like, I was speaking to Vic one day, and he was saying he drove into one of those petrol stations after the 1207, and one of the guys who was helping him, petrol attendant, and he looked at him, and Victor is like, what the hell have I done? You know, like, was I kind? And this guy is like, Victor Medfield. Thank you so much for making me a world champion.
No.
That's what it is. Special. That's why when it's about us. It's how we sort of shout on top of our lungs and stand on rooftops and climb mountains and dive in the deepest seas, because these gentlemen, what they've given us, the green and gold. I mean, do you think that we've won it three times? Small third world country in the bottom of Africa has most of the time, every 12 years, brought a smile. Hopefully, it doesn't get that long. It's quarterfinal time. And in UFC, and they say, it's time. Oh. Yeah, it's blockbusting time. Quarterfinals are hella interesting. I look at the Irish and the New Zealand, and I get excited just thinking about the style of play. But looking to foresight, like looking further on, can you imagine when Razor Scott Robinson takes over the All Blacks, the type of rugby that he sort of coached at Super Rugby, and Ronan O'Gara with La Rochelle's success and what type of a coach that he is, and them going against each other for the next 4 years after this World Cup, is going to be the best rugby we're going to watch. Mm. We're going to see, we're going to be so inspired. It's going to help younger coaches, going to help players to understanding what this really game is about. So that is me getting excited. I just geek out on those little things. I'm such a I'm a rugby geek. I can watch an a 14-8 game and be excited by like a scrum off who didn't do anything, didn't have no line breaks, just because the way that he passes off the deck is just phenomenal. He's like the next Aaron Smith, who was the former Graham Bishop, who played against the Springboks in 1995, because that's where me and rugby. So I'm trying to hold back on the French game. Because
you're already saying past the World Cup.
Jeepers, we got a massive one.
Yeah,
I was speaking to Hanyani Shimangi. Funny enough, Shimi and I, we made our professional debuts together. Story backline, the backstory to this is we on a Rondebosch tour. We're in school together. We're on a Rondebosch tour in 1996, and we're having a big up. And I say, so Shim says to me, "Bobs, we going pro, bro." I said, "Yeah, bro, we going pro, bro." And we made our debuts in the same time. He was off the bench for the Sharks. I was off the bench for the Lions. And we got there. The touch judge sort of pulls up our numbers. And Shim looks at me, and I look at him, I say, "We going pro, bro." That's such a special moment. Thing. And he was saying, "Bobs, I'm nervous." I said,
"I'm super nervous."
I look at this French side, and I see no weakness. Mm-mm. I look at what they have done and how far they have come. And to the level of Fabien Galthié, played in the 1999 World Cup, beat the New Zealanders in the semi-final, got into the final, but leading up to that final, the French were so ecstatic about their victory against All Blacks that they were on the up till Thursday, leading up to the World Cup final in 1999. And they got flogged by Australia in that final. He went through that. Then in 2003, French team, at their best, him playing with a young Michalak, play a semi-final against England, and Johnny Wilkinson squeezes him out of that. He's had these experiences. He's had this of the French people, where they pitch today or will they not pitch today. He's been through it all. One of his mentors and a rugby sort of guru to him is Nick Mallett. And Nick talks about how this young man, he was, you know, there's players who play and he's just gifted in a natural, and his players who are almost like captains and coaches in the game. And you could see that with Fabian when he was playing when he was a youngster. And now, to them in France, it's almost like as if the stars are aligned. This is the time. This is why an Antoine Dupont doesn't want to miss this game. Mm. He'd rather play with a broken cheek. Mm. When do you ever get a chance to play a quarterfinal
at home
in front of your natives?
Yeah.
And against. With the best opportunity against the world champions. Mm. I was saying, if it was me, I will play. If it was my son, I would have told him no. So I'm looking forward to it. And there's more to it. This French team, on the 20 side of this group, was a 2017, 2018 under 20 champions.
Yeah.
These guys have been looking down and idolizing all the Southern Hemisphere players. These guys have been under the tutelage and even intellectual properties of Jerome Kaino. All those players that have come to France have given so much back to this young group of players who now understand and believe and know exactly what it is to face pressure. You saw how they embraced playing that opening game against New Zealand.
Yep.
When I say embrace it, they were comfortable in their skin.
Yeah.
They didn't change who they are. They play to what they believe in. They are so well entrenched in their progress to the fact that last week before they play against Italy, Fabien Galthié was talking about this is the 14th week plan that we planned 4 years ago.
My goodness.
That's what we're up against.
Mm.
Sure, Bobs. I must be honest. I never dived in it historically, what you just said there. But, and Arthur, come in here now. But tell me, what are they up against? Tell me the other side.
So I watched them against Italy, and I've seen them a few times how they played. I get encouraged, and actually, one of the best games we played on the 12th of November 2022 last year was against France with 14 men.
I remember that. We almost beat them.
Almost beat them.
We, for the first time, in a partisan crowd, hostile environment, where everyone was blamed for bad. Like, they were just going for us. We just lost against Ireland, which I thought we let that game go.
Yeah, yeah.
And in this time around, the confidence of the Springboks on how to break away from their own 22, the distribution. I mean, there's one of the plays where Manili Bok on transitional play decides to go wide and Sia is out there and he just does a quick hands, gives it to Kurt Lee Aronson. I mean, I can vividly sort of see this. I just start tasting it and smelling the deep heat. And then he gets into they keep on playing and throwing themselves because they knew that they had to cover for that one man who does all the hard work, Peter Steph Du Toit.
Yeah.
Do you understand what you have to do to make sure that you can add the value that he brings and he's not on that pitch and there's 14 of you and how much he will have done?
Yeah.
Mm.
And to me, that encouraged me because I could see a Springbok team growing, meaning that the moment didn't scare them. They lived it. They went at it. They pushed France. And France, they're up against a tough side, a group that played in this quarterfinal against the host nation who everyone favored, Japan, against Japan in Japan. They've been through this moment.
Yeah.
They understand what it's going to take. Funny enough, old Francois Swayze de Brain. he was talking about just catching up, leading up to this week.
That's when Swayze de Brain. At the moment, there. I mean, my mates are tired and spanner. And I mean, for
Sway Salmon.
Yeah, we are so I love you, Oaks. I'm one of you, but it. Sway and span it.
And he was talking about the planning that goes through it. And he had a sort of like a just informal chat with Rassi and Jacques. And they were saying they have left no stone unturned.
Do you think losing to Ireland was a plan?
Do I think it was a plan?
Because everyone is saying to convince themselves.
You have to respect the professional integrity of the Springbok side.
Yeah, 100%.
Same as Ireland, where everybody said last weekend, you know. What are they going to do?
You never want to lose in that green jersey.
Yeah. No, you don't.
Yeah. You never. I just don't see it. It's one of those things. Yes, for me, when I watch that game, I'm saying this now, I just don't think the boys had the plan, but they didn't believe how well it was working.
Yeah,
and to them, it almost like surprised them, because Rassi is that kind of guy. He's such a genius. He sees things ahead, and he says this is going to work. Ireland, with all the best, they got the most entries in everyone's opposition's 22. We stole 6 lineouts off them. They scored the most tries from lineouts.
Yeah.
They're the similar sort of DNA as Leinster. That's how they played. And South Africa, the way we started that first 20 minutes intensity, the way we played, the freedom that we had. Yeah. Yes, there were some few decision-making and there's a few technical things that Ireland does better than most, like holding you in the rack, making sure that you can't get... I mean, South Africa, we just turn over balls so much and we never get the best outcomes from our position. Which everyone says, yeah, no, we're not ruthless enough about it, which is something that they'll work on, and they'll have learnt a lot more from that Irish game. You're going to be up against a team that's going to be literally guys who want to die in that field. They're going to scrum. I'm a bit skeptical about the match official that we have. I would have loved if we had Crowley that refed us against New Zealand, because he rewarded our sort of set piece dominance.
Yeah, and he flowed.
He can't let you want Ben O'Keefe, who's refereeing this weekend, to allow us to dominate, to let us scrum deep if we want to scrum deep, to keep that ball for a second shove instead of telling us to let it go. The tendency in the Southern Hemisphere is to use set piece as a resetting of the game, but with us, it's part of how we it's almost like we teleport ourselves from 22 to 22. Give ourselves an attacking opportunity. So we want to get those penalties. Mauling, I don't think France has got the best technique and technically that good at stopping mauls. Yes, they're going to work on it over the week because they know that's what they'll be up against. We want to make sure that we can give Ben O'Keefe a situation where he can read the right pictures and not let them get away with that, because I think our set piece is going to define where we go in this game. And that first 20 minutes, the intensity and the... It's easy to say, South Africa's got a rushing defense. Jeepers, have you seen those boys rush? Yeah. Have you seen their... We've got the most dominant tackle stats in the Rugby World Cup. Yes, you can look at it and we're probably like 81%. But that 81%, 30% of that... is you seeing your ass.
Yeah.
And that gives you opportunity if you can turn that ball over and play from that transition, because now it opens up flooding gates to flood the breakdown and then play from it. So if we can start and make sure that we can manage the long kicking game that France is going to bring to us, because they don't want to kick out. They don't want to face our driving mall. They don't want to face our lineouts. So what they want to do, they want to make us make decisions. They want to entice Damien Willemse to have a crack and step and try and counter-attack so that they can set up traps and beat us into this breakdown. Because that's what they did. That's how we lost that 2022, because we gave away 6 turnovers.
Yeah.
And that was not just that. It was our lineouts that they attacked too, because Wilkie is brilliant in the front jumping pod, but I don't think he's an Eben.
What do you think if you, for my super brew pick?
Yeah.
No, I'm just so if you had to guess, the score not so relevant, but who's going to go through the quarterfinals?
Between all four.
All four. We can't leave England, Wales, Fiji out.
But let's take a moment in the segment to do the predictions. I like that.
Yeah.
So tell us your feeling for the two games, or the, it's all four games this week.
All four.
All four. Yeah. Can you take us through that?
And we're not going to judge you.
Yeah, I don't know.
To go against South Africa.
Oh no, I'm fine. Don't worry about this. I'm going Fiji, England. If Fiji plays the same sort of type of template game that they played against Australia, where they kicked pressure and they didn't want to play too much, I could see them going through. But England, because of that's the same group that lost in the final in 2019. Yeah. I think those. They have learned a lot. I think they've learned a lot.
There's been a few controversies, even this World Cup.
Don't forget these Fijians. This is the last time this group of players can make a massive name for themselves. Correct. Because they are on their last of their legs and they're superstars that they do have. So it's going to be a fight, but I think England will win it ugly. Wales, Argentina, I see Wells coming through that. Okay. Weird enough, I think Warren Gatland has got a chance to make that quarterfinal look like how it looked a semifinal against us.
Yeah.
Where he give you nothing and you have to do all the playing. And the way that Argentina is so seduced to playing with the ball in hand, I think they'll play into their hands unless they change their tactics to back to what they did in 2007 when they beat the host nations, France. So I'm going Wales. Ireland, New Zealand. This is where I'm going. Come on, the All Blacks. I think the All Blacks are going to win it.
I think
the All Blacks are a team that lots of things is going against them at the moment. But for this group, after they lost against France, they knew that.
They knew.
Yes.
You can see something happen.
And it's not about the revenge of losing the series. No, it's about the pride of the little small nation with more sheep than people.
Yeah.
And they want to make sure that people recognize and realize that they're three-time champions. Mm. And Ireland, I don't see any weaknesses in what they do. But I think they've flocked their players. I think their players are going to get into a stage where if that starting 15 doesn't set a base strong enough, I don't think they can live with New Zealand when New Zealand starts going and they start going. Tactically, I think Ireland will play this game very much in a way of strangle and suffocate, get more 22 entries against New Zealand, play them off their lineouts and play them off their feet. But I think New Zealand, what they're going to do is going to be a snatch and grab. South Africa versus France, I'm going for the box. I think the Springboks have it in them to really shut the crowd out, but they'll need to have scoreboard pressure
from the beginning,
from the start, and take every single little opportunity. And
just 3 points,
and just you have to make this game as boring as possible. Play at your tempo, walk set piece to set piece. The only thing is about focusing on task and giving yourself enough time with ball out of play where you can connect and still make sure that people stay on task. And in that way, you don't lose where your targets are and constantly outwork and outpassion them, because it's going to be massive. So that is my semifinal. So Wales, England, South Africa, and New Zealand. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Well, I think this has been incredible this morning. Bobs, I tell you, I can sit here. We can dive into so much deep of it. But can I put you on the spot to ask you that we do one more of these before the World Cup?
No, finally. I'm good for it.
Okay, because I'm now you're committing on a live on a show. Yeah,
I committed to you guys. I committed to you guys when no one was there, and to your listeners, viewers, thank you so much for having me, and to you, gents. This is a special thing. It's good. We need to tell our stories, and we need to share all of these platforms. I think the more platforms there are in South Africa where people can speak their mind and get to know each other, the better it is. Talking is therapeutic, and it helps the person who tells the story to sort of unveil and see themselves.
Kubani. Bob's for me from here on.
That's how I am. Thanks, Mr. Kluti.
Spake it or span it. But Arthur, anything from your side? Last word?
You know what? I've been in awe today, to be honest.
Yeah.
Just listening.
Yeah.
And having the privilege of sitting in the seats and just listening to the stories and listening to the knowledge. This is why I wake up in the morning. So thank you for your time. It was unbelievable.
Sam, I'll jump straight on that, Arthur, and say I think both of it, we both realized what we just went through with Bob's. And thank you for the inspiration this morning. Thank you for sharing all the stories with us, Bob's. Honestly, I don't think you understand. And just this Saturday, there was a youngster that came to us at Blair Athol.
Yeah.
And he approached me at Blair Athol with Ilandre. And he said, Albert, I know you just keep going. Because you guys don't understand what it means to the people that do listen to it and how much we learn from it. Your dad, a very special shout out to him. Mm-hmm. And your mom also for obviously the pieces that was taken over there. And all your siblings that's in your life as well. For the role you play in South Africa, the inspiration that you are to all of us, Bobs. And the humbleness and humility in which you approached everything this morning, Bob. I can tell you now that this morning I learned a shitload from what everything I went, what we talked about this morning is, I think I'm going to have more privilege or more benefit to it than anybody else.
Myself too. I'm going to listen to this.
And we bless you and everything you do, and also the kids and the journey. And we cannot wait to catch up with you again. And hopefully, for those that are putting money on this games, I would say, get your bets in based on these analyses. He comes from the bibliothèque. Remember, bibliothèque. He's the bibliothèque.
At least it was not a thumbsuck.
Exactly. Well, us, it's emotion.
I'm just sitting here and I'm like nervous for all the
boys. I am so nervous for the boys. See ya. Come on, boys.